Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and enjoy a glass of refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry sets up a coruscating quartet who do battle with your questions. Here's how it goes. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps our board of experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, you receive a complete 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Mind you, this is only if your question stumps our board of experts. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was received first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City. And now may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and completely unrehearsed, Information Please continues on its carefree way. The experts this evening include the poet and conductor of the New York Post's Conning Tower, Franklin P. Adams, the sports expert and general wise man, John Kieran, the composer, pianist, author, and motion picture actor, Oscar Levant, and as our guest, the noted historian, Louis Hacker, whose important book, The Triumph of American Capitalism, has just been published. Remember, listeners, for each question that's missed, Canada Dry rings up $10, and that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the latest edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, we'll start with a question that comes from Louis F. Kahn of Baltimore. I have three ladies here on my card, I should make clear, and I'm going
Sounds
to ask
like
you...
Sounds like a poker term.
No. You three queens, you mean? Mm-hmm. No. Listen to this, Mr. Adams. In what states did each of these three ladies achieve fame? In what states? States of the Union. Get two out of three. The first is Barbara Frietchie. Barbara Frietchie, Mr. Levant.
Maryland.
Maryland, yes. Do you remember the circumstances?
I saw it in an operetta called My Maryland.
Oh, that's how you...
Silvery Moon was the plug waltz.
Mr. Kieran, can you supplement Mr. Levant's
Green
correct
walled
answer?
By the hills of Maryland.
That would do it. Fine. It's from a poem, of course, Mr. Adams, by Whittier.
J.G. Whittier.
Very good. Now, how about Betsy Ross? Betsy Ross achieved fame in what state? Mr. Hacker.
In Philadelphia. Betsy Ross was the lady who was commissioned to sew the flag for the United States.
At least that is the is
city.
A commonly
that's the
accepted
legend,
story.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania
yes.
is the state.
Yes, Pennsylvania is the state. Philadelphia is the city.
Right.
That's splitting hairs, Mr. Levant. Molly Pitcher achieved fame in what state? Molly Pitcher, Mr. Kieran.
I think I was in Vermont.
No.
Molly Pitcher? No, you got the wrong state. Vermont is much
Molly
on the
Stark.
Minds of Republicans these days, Mr. Kieran. I can excuse you. Mr. Hacker.
Molly Pitcher achieved fame in Pennsylvania. It was at the Battle of Monmouth during the American Revolution.
Oh, yes, but I don't think Monmouth is in Pennsylvania.
In New Jersey, then.
In New Jersey, yes. Well, we didn't have so many states in those days, Mr. Hacker. You can get it, of course, if you just go down the list. Well, that's one wrong. Molly Pitcher, New Jersey, the Battle of Monmouth, and that gives us two out of three, which is okay, and sends us on to Ann M. Odom's question. Miss Odom is a native of Youngstown, Ohio. Identify the following. These are three vice presidents. Get two out of three. The first is a vice president of the United States who negotiated at one time to head a new nation. Who was that? Mr. Kieran had his hand up first.
Aaron Burr.
Aaron Burr, yes. And what was the new nation that he was trying to establish?
He was going to found it himself, the whole southwest of this nation.
Yes, that's quite right. And it failed. How about a vice president of the United States who became Secretary of War of another government? That's a tricky one. Hands, Mr. Levant.
I don't know it, but by deduction, it must be during the Civil War.
Not bad.
Now, how about Mr. Hacker?
President?
Go ahead.
Mr. Hacker, pick up. Mr. Levant's hint is very good and very intelligent, Mr.
Well, it
Hacker.
Wasn't Jefferson Vice, Davis.
No,
it, was his
it would be Alexander move. Stephen then, who became vice president of the Confederacy.
No, I'm sorry. The vice president of the United States who became Secretary of War of the Confederate States was John C. Breckinridge, who became Secretary of War of the Confederate States of America. That gives us one wrong. How about the third? A vice president of the United States who resigned. Who resigned? Mr. Adams? Well, that was your hand, wasn't it, Mr. Adams? I thought I was seeing things. I've never seen a man take his hand down more quickly. Any guesses? Mr. Hacker, just run through your American history, Mr. Hacker, quickly. The answer is John C. Calhoun, who was vice president in 1825 and resigned to enter the Senate.
Yes.
I'm afraid that loses Canada Dry, $10, and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica going out to Miss Odom. Thank you. And sending us on to a question from William E. McGlynn of Niagara County, New York. This is a lighter question, gentlemen. It's about dancing. We should have one about light wines, Mr. Adams, shouldn't we? Get 2 out of 3 if you can. 1, whose heart, quote, danced with daffodils? Mr. Kieran.
Wordsworth.
Wordsworth, yes. Can you give us the lines?
And then my heart with rapture thrilled, with rapture thrills and dances with the daffodils.
Yes,
and,
that's quite daffodil. Right. Yeah, it's pleasure, instead of rapture, as Mr. Adams reminds us. Mr. Adams had his hand up, too, and I'm sure knew the answer. 2, who was, quote, in heaven when he danced? Close quote. Mr. Levant.
Anyone who dances cheek to cheek.
That's right. can you remember the lines?
Heaven, I'm in heaven. Dancing, 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 cheek to cheek.
Very charming. That's right. Who danced by the light of the moon? Who danced by the light of the moon? Mr. Kieran.
Why, the wedding guests at the wedding of the owl and the pussycat. And the married pair.
Yes, and the principals themselves, the owl and the pussycat. Hand in hand on the edge of the sand, danced by the light of the moon, according to what writer? Mr. Adams?
Edward Lear.
Edward Lear. That gives us 3 questions out of 3. 3 answers out of 3 about dancing. How about this one? This is a somewhat more serious question from Lillian Cohen of Detroit. Get 2 out of 3 on this, gentlemen. What country has acquired each of these territories since the current war began? The first territory is a territory called Northern Bukovina. I may be mispronouncing that mildly. Mr. Hacker.
Russia.
Russia. From whom?
From Romania.
From Romania. The territory called Berbera, B-E-R-B-E-R-A. Who acquired it?
It's the name of a raincoat, too. Berbery. Oh, that's Berbery.
No, that's a Berbery, I think.
May I guess?
Mr. Hacker, of course.
It sounds Italian. It's part of the Italian campaign in
who got it?
In Africa, Italy.
Italy from?
Somaliland.
From Britain, I assume.
From Great Britain, yes, by conquest. That's right. Now, the third piece of territory, the Faroe Islands, F-A-R-O-E. Mr. Levant.
That's off Iceland, I think. And I think the British took it after the fall of Denmark. I'm not sure.
That's right.
They didn't take it. I think they just established bases there.
Well, they took it in self-defense, and they're going to give it back to Denmark after the current war is over. And that gives us 3 out of 3 and sends us on to this question from Benjamin H. Anderson of Mansfield, Massachusetts. This is a musical question which you all should come in on, gentlemen. We've taken a group of 3 pairs of songs. In each pair, there is a similar musical phrase. I'll name the songs, and then they're going to be played, and you tell the order in which they were played. Now, the first pair of songs is Tell Me More and Says My Heart. Now, the musical phrase is going to be played. It's very similar in each of those songs. Give me the proper order. Go right ahead. Now the second half of the pair. Okay, Mr. Levant had his hand up.
The second one, which was the original, and I don't want any letters.
The second one played by the
Tell Me More by George Gershwin. The second one was the result, at least by influence, called Says My Heart.
That's right.
See, that's similar, though.
They are very
similar. The only difference is in a syncopation.
Do you suppose that's mere coincidence, Mr. Levant?
I think there was almost a trial on that.
Is that so?
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. Now we'll have the second pair of songs and see whether we can do as well. I'll give you the names of the songs, but not necessarily in the order in which they were played. The 2 songs are Sierra Sue and Would You Care. In what order were they played? Mr. Kieran.
Would You Care was played second and was written first, I believe.
That would leave what as played first, Mr. Kieran?
Sierra Sue.
Sierra Sue.
Good work.
That's right. Right.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Kieran. That's very good. The first one played was Sierra Sue. The second, Would You Care. Was that a coincidence, more or less, Mr. Levant? Do you know anything about that?
Oh, I don't involve me in that. I have a tough enough life as it is.
All right. We'll let you out this time. And now the third pair consists of Little Man, You've Had a Busy Day, and Scatterbrain. That is not necessarily the order in which the phrases will now be played. Oh, Only one has been played so far, Mr. LeMay.
No, they both have been played.
Have they both been played?
Sure. I mean, there's similar phrases played twice with one difference, which
I
you wouldn't
see
get,
difference
Mr.
at all.
Fadiman. The first phrase had a semitone, and then ya da 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 instead of ya da da da. That's the difference, Mr. Fadiman. Which means that the second one is, little man, you've had a busy day. Da-dum. Little man, you've had a busy day.
I can just
the first one is scatterbrain.
The first one's scatterbrain. The second, little man, you've had a busy day. Thanks for the technical explanation, which, as you say, I don't understand, Mr. Levant. That gives us 3 out of 3. Credit not only to Mr. Levant, but to Mr. Kieran on that one. The second from Mrs. Ethel, the next question from Mrs. Ethel Price of Toledo. Again, a 2 out of 3 question, if you can get it. Where in literature or song do the following playing cards play an important role? Now, the first is the Jack of Hearts. The Jack of Hearts plays an important role in Mr. Kieran.
Jack of Hearts plays an important part in Alice in Wonderland. He stole the tarts.
Yes, stole the tarts. Is he called the Jack of Hearts there?
The Knave of Hearts.
The Knave of Hearts, which is another name. Mr. Adams, were you going to...
I don't think that's in Alice.
Where is it?
It's in Mother Goose.
Yes, I think just...
The Knave of Hearts, he stole those tarts.
They tried him in Alice in Wonderland.
Trials do seem to be coming up this evening. I think the poem is quoted, certainly, in Alice in Wonderland, Mr. Adams. It may have originally appeared in Mother Goose.
Stealing tarts.
The Queen of Hearts, she made some tarts all on a summer day. The Knave of Hearts, he stole those tarts and took them quite away. I think either answer would be correct. Thank you. Now, the second card is the Two of Clubs. What story or song would you find the Two of Clubs playing an important part in?
Probably a detective story.
No, Mr. Adams, though it's an intelligent guess, as we should expect from you.
Two of Clubs isn't worth much in any game, I know
not,
that.
Not unsupported. Not unsupported. The Two of Clubs. It's not easy, gentlemen. It's The Outcasts of Poker Flat by Bret Hart. The ending of that story, the hero or villain, if you wish, his body is found underneath a tree, and on the tree is pinned the Deuce of Clubs. Together
Jack
with
Oakhurst.
I beg pardon?
Jack Oakhurst.
Why, you know everything, Mr. Adams. That's quite right. And there we find that the Oakhurst's death is explained, is written out, the explanation is written out on the Two of Clubs. That's pretty recherché, and I don't think you deserve much discredit for not knowing it. See if you can get the next. And third, the Jack of Diamonds. Where in literature or song would you find the Jack of Diamonds, Mr. Adams?
Waterboy.
Waterboy is right. Can you help us out with a line or two?
You Jack of Diamonds, you Jack of Diamonds. You robbed my pocket of silver and gold.
Yeah, I listen to you all night. That's very good. Thank you very much.
It's recherché, too.
Yeah.
Okay, Pop.
Now, the, let's see. I think we have to listen now for a minute or two to Mr. Milton Cross.
Many times during these past 2 years, you've heard me call Canada Dry the champagne of ginger ales. One reason why Canada Dry deserves that lofty title is that only the finest ginger in the world is used in its preparation. Our resident buyer in Jamaica sees to that. Another reason for the title is the exclusive process employed by Canada Dry to extract all the rich natural goodness of this excellent ginger. The delicate flavor, essence, and aroma are transferred without loss from the sun-cured ginger root to this sparkling ginger ale. And still a third reason for the title, Champagne of Ginger Ales, is the use of a secret formula for blending and mixing the choice ingredients. So whenever you order ginger ale, make sure it's Canada Dry. It's a pleasant aid to digestion, a quick energy giver, and a refreshing, delicious beverage. Be sure to put Canada Dry, the champagne of ginger ales, at the very top of tomorrow's shopping list.
Mr. Cross, we've clocked you in exactly 55 seconds. And now we'll go on with the second half of the program, opening with a question from Elizabeth W. Baird of Los Angeles. Get 3 out of 4 on this, gentlemen. It's a quotation question, a quotation spotting question. What's the source of these quotations? What was the occasion, if you can give me it, for each of them? The first is a very famous one. Our country, right or wrong? We have 1, 2 hands. Mr. Levant was first.
Stephen Decatur.
Stephen Decatur, yes. When
our
did
country,
he say it?
Our country, right or wrong, our country. It did appear for a year every day on the title page of the editorial page of the Daily News. That's how I know it.
Yes.
He was a naval commander, I think, probably. They were all around 1812 and so forth.
Yes, well, this
quotation, which was not a quotation at the time, was uttered when? Mr. Hacker, would you know?
A little earlier, when he had been sent on an expedition against the Barbary pirates who were interfering with American commerce proceeding into the Mediterranean.
Was this before the War of 1812?
Yes, before the War of
1812. I have 1816 down on my card. Would I be wrong?
I don't know. I'm not certain. But I know he did participate in such an expedition.
That's quite true. But I think he uttered the statement about our country, right or wrong, in a toast at Norfolk, Virginia, in 1816.
May she always be right.
Our country, in her intercourse with foreign nations, may she always be in the right, as Mr. Adams reminds us, but our country, right or wrong. Now, the second quotation is, now he belongs to the ages. Spot that one. Mr. Adams.
That was supposed to have been said by, I think, Stanton.
That's right.
Who was Stanton, Mr. Adams?
He was the Secretary of War.
And
he
said it?
Lincoln's administration, and was supposed to have said it at the time of Lincoln's death.
Yes, if he didn't say it, he should have. It's a very good statement. Third, now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party. Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party, Mr. Adams.
I think that's a typewriter exercise.
It is. Do you know whether it was ever uttered under highly historical circumstances, Mr. Adams?
I think not.
That's right. It's simply an exercise, as Mr. Adams tells us. It was devised by Charles E. Weller to test the practicability of the first typewriter, constructed by a man named Scholes in 1867. Information which I'm sure everybody has by this time completely forgotten.
Oh, I know about Scholes.
Did you know about him, Mr. Adams? How about this one? How am I doing, Edna? That unfortunate sound was Mr. Kieran. Mr. Levant.
Well, Mr. Kieran knows it.
I'm sure he does.
He was... Come on, let's say it together. I'll say it.
Schoolboy
Row.
Yes.
Only he wasn't doing so well at the time.
Can you give us the circumstances, Mr. Kieran?
Why, that was in the 1934 World Series when the Detroit Tigers were engaged in being thrown around by the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yeah.
And Schoolboy Row went on the air and had something to say about the ball game. But at the end he said, how am I doing, Edna? Having, I believe, the Mrs. Row of today... being at the other end of some listening machine.
That's right.
Radio, they call it.
That's exactly right. Thank you, Mr. Levant. Thank you, Mr. Kieran. Oh, that gives us 4 out of 4. What can you do with this? This comes from Philip LaPorta of Montreal. Name the personality who plays himself in each of these movies. There are 3. Get 2 out of 3. The first movie is Strike Up the Band. Who plays himself? Mr. Levant.
Paul Whiteman.
Paul Whiteman, yes. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Who plays himself in that movie? Mr. Levant again.
Jimmy Stewart plays a scoutmaster.
Yes, but I think under another name.
That's before he's a senator. I don't know what happens.
Who plays himself?
Well, nobody really does.
No, the answer is the eminent radio commentator, H.V. Kaltenborn, appears as H.V. Kaltenborn, so as to have no confusion of identity, in the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. That gives us 1 wrong. Get the next one right. Who plays himself in the movie 100 Men and a Girl?
Ha-ha.
Mr. Levant.
Leopold Stokowski.
Leopold Stokowski, that's right. Mr. Adams had his hand up, and I'm sure I knew the answer, too. That gives us 2 out of 3. What can you do with this one? From George P. Bisson of this city. Get 2 out of 3 if you can. Well, this will run you boys back quite a few years. It's possible that Mr. Levant and Mr. Hacker might not know the answer to this. Don't forget tomorrow's draft time, Mr. Hacker, Mr. Levant. Identify these comic strip characters of yesteryear. Get 2 out of 3. Now, the first comic strip character was a tramp with a sort of tin can hat. Mr. Hacker had his
happy
hand up.
Happy Hooligan.
Yes, Happy Hooligan, that's right. It was in your time, Mr. Hacker,
oh,
wasn't it?
Oh, by all means. And before your time, Mr. Fanning.
Yes, of course. The second was an elderly gentleman who played pranks with his grandsons. Mr. Adams.
Probably Foxy Grandpa.
You bet. Who drew Foxy Grandpa, Mr. Adams? Do you remember?
I think his name was Schultz.
That's right. I haven't the slightest idea how you remembered that. Mr. Levant, what
Well, as a matter of fact, I think less than 2 years now. He died in Greenwich Village under not good circumstances. That was quite a story.
Is that so?
That's how I know about it.
You know about things
well,
in the art
I didn't mean
that
to be funny. I meant that was touching.
Quite right. Well, that gives us 2 of these immortal characters. How about the third? Now, these 2 gentlemen in the comic strips used to get into trouble always because of their extreme courtesy. Mr. Kieran.
Ferdy and Percy.
The hallroom boys?
That's right.
I don't think that's... I remember them.
Alphonse and Gaston.
Alphonse and Gaston, the comic Frenchmen.
That's
Ferdy and Percy were not noted particularly for their courtesy. I'm not sure, Mr. Kieran.
After you, my dear Alphonse, is still in the language.
That's right. And what did the other boy say? Yes,
I think he was a silent man.
Just a stooge. And who drew the Alphonse
there,
and Gaston?
I don't know.
Oh, that was a very famous cartoonist. Do you know, Mr. Levant?
If you give me both names, I'd know. I don't know.
Fred Upper. Fred Upper was the artist who drew the Alphonse and Gaston cartoons. Now, the next question is from S. Newton of Atlanta. What did the following have in common? Here are three phrases. The wild cats of Georgia, red dogs of Indiana, and stump tails of Wisconsin. Sound like football teams. Mr. Hacker.
Those were state banks which began to operate after the Second Bank of the United States had been discontinued. And the name was applied to paper circulation of currency, which really had no gold cover and therefore was inconvertible.
That's 100% right, Mr. Hacker. Thank you. And do you know why they got those particular names, wildcats, red dogs, and stump tails?
It may be that some of the designations on the faces of the notes had some resemblance.
I mean, they seem like very picturesque phrases.
Yeah.
Thought I might catch you on that, but I find that that's covered in your book, The Triumph of American Capitalism, on page 333 and 334.
I got to write a book.
How about this?
Another book.
We'll be waiting for it, Mr. Adams, outside. Dorothy Fury of Belmont, Massachusetts, sends this one in. Three-part question. Get two out of three. In what English novel is a Beethoven quartet important? Mr. Levant.
Mr. Huxley's novel, Point Counterpoint.
That's exactly right. How'd you happen to remember that, Mr. Levant?
I know that book from memory.
That's pretty good going.
Not altogether, but
Spandrel
commits suicide to the slow movement of the Opus 132 A minor quartet. I asked Mr. Huxley why he chose that movement.
Why?
He never told me why. It's pretty slow.
The movement or Mr. Huxley?
The movement.
Oh, I didn't get it. That's exactly right. A record of the A minor quartet is played as Spandrel dies. And that's pretty good going, I think, Mr. Levant. How about this one? In what movie did Il Trovatore play an important part? I remember this one myself.
Yeah.
Mr. Adams.
That might have been one of the Marx Brothers movies.
Night at the Opera.
Yes, that's pure intuition on your part.
No,
isn't it,
I heard that.
Did you? What was the one, Mr. Levant?
A Night at the Opera.
A Night at the Opera. Runs all the way through it. Also, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, isn't that?
That's included in the Il Trovatore. They don't do it at the Met that way.
Might not be a bad idea.
Should have been.
They did.
Yeah. You and I have the same idea, Mr. Adams. I'll sell you my box, Mr. Adams, by the way, if you wish. How about this? In what contemporary short story does a song of the 90s play a major part? In what contemporary short story does a song of the 90s play a major part? Well, when I tell you the answer, you'll all know it.
Oh.
Mr. Levant, does that make it clear to you?
If you sing it, I'll know it.
No, you wouldn't. That's where you make a big mistake. I could sing it, but you wouldn't know it even less than you do now.
Now, you do something for us. You sing it, please.
How's that?
The Man on the Flying Trapeze.
That's right. I gave you 2.5 notes.
Now, you got me mixed up.
That was Mr. Adams, the flute-like tones of Adams. The Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze, yes, by William Saroyan, is the current contemporary short story that uses that old song. Mrs. Robert K. Bantz of Fairfield, Connecticut. By the way, it's about time I stumped you, gentlemen. Wants you to answer this one. Give four common expressions. That means popular expressions, gentlemen. Be careful. Give four popular expressions which mention members of the family, but do not necessarily concern them. For example, to be a sissy or a granny would be an example of a popular expression mentioning members of the family. Mr. Kieran.
So's your old man.
So's your old man's a dandy. That's all right. Mr. Levant.
Baby needs a pair of shoes.
That's very good. Yeah. That gives us two.
All ready?
Mr. Kieran?
A spear that knows no brother.
I beg pardon?
A spear that knows no brother.
A spear?
Spear that knows no brother.
I've never heard that before.
Oh, that's very old.
Really? Sounds a little elegant, though. Rather formal. Mr. Adams?
Be a sister to you.
Yes, to be a sister to you would be another one. Mr. Levant?
Cry uncle. Or say
yes,
uncle.
That would be good. Yeah. Pop goes the weasel has occurred to me as a possibility. Any
Mom
others?
Mom goes the weasel in our house.
Any of those would do. To mother someone, perhaps. To ante up might just about get by. There are a number of others you could use. Jay Harvey of Ontario sends this one in. Recite a line from a poem or song about a young lady who was, and I'm going to give you three adjectives, yet two out of three. The first young lady was coy. Can you recite a line from a poem or song about a coy young lady? It's not easy. Mr. Adams?
You don't mean uncertain, coy, and hard to please?
That would be very good. Who wrote that line?
Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Kieran. I didn't know that at all. What
woman in our hours of ease, uncertain, coy, and
that's
hard to please?
Very good. The one I was thinking of was Andrew Marvel's poem, To His Coy Mistress. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness lady were no crime. But then he goes on to convince her to the opposite effect, as you remember, Mr. Adams. But your answer is perfectly correct. Now, how about a bashful young lady? Mr. Adams.
Here's to the something of bashful 15.
Maiden.
Maiden of bashful 15, and here's to the something of
widow.
Widow, yes.
Widow of
50.
You leave out your nouns. The widow of 50. That's right.
May the toast pass, something like
that. That's right. It's from what play, Mr. Adams?
The Hounds of Bash.
Probably
Shobo.
Sheridan.
That was Mr. Levant. I want to give due discredit. yes, School for Scandal. Did you say that?
I said Sheridan.
Sheridan, School for Scandal. Now, how about Delicate? Delicate? Oh, there's a line of poetry about a young lady with the adjective delicate in it. I think there's probably only one.
It's Chicken Skin, Delicate White is the beginning of a ballad by Austin Dobson.
I'll take it. That sounds absolutely okay. Another one
this
is
this was the Pompadour's Fan.
That's right. I remember that. The Lass with a Delicate Air is an old English song with the word delicate in it. Well, now let's see. Mr. Cross, we're all waiting for a word from you.
The next time you order sparkling Canada Dry water, watch the thousands of tiny bubbles that rise and scintillate like miniature stars when the bottle is opened. Notice, too, how this club soda sparkles so smoothly as it cascades from the open bottle into the mixings of your favorite drink. Well, there is a real reason why those bubbles are so tiny, why this club soda sparkles so evenly and for such a long time. The reason is pinpoint carbonation, a special Canada Dry process that imparts a long-lasting sparkle and adds a just-right tangy flavor that makes so much difference in a club soda. Yes, the goodness of sparkling Canada Dry water is not the result of a hit-and-miss formula, but an exact formula worked out by chemists over a period of years. And as a result, today, sparkling Canada Dry water is the most popular of all club sodas.
A rapid calculation reveals that Canada Dry has sustained a total loss of $10 in one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mr. Hacker, thank you for lending us your excellent aid this evening. Next week, Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran will be aided and abetted by the well-known composer and radio commentator, Deems Taylor, and by the present chairman of the New York State Racing Commission, the ex-newspaper tycoon and critic at large, Mr. Herbert Bayard Swope. Remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. If your question stumps our experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, a complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember, send letters with questions and the correct answers to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City.
Canada Dry wants to take this opportunity to remind you that your community chest needs your contribution to meet the urgent needs of your own fellow citizens.